The doctors that examined the injured man were baffled by the precision in which the eye was removed. No doctors or technique that they were aware of could perform that kind of operation. The alien instrument, on its own, completed a complex procedure in a split second. The alien gadget cauterized all the blood vessels without damaging the eye socket or the eyeball. Headline: Disappearing Act. The first week that the scientists started experimenting with the alien objects, the gadgets began disappearing. At first, it was thought that a trickster, one of the scientists, was playing pranks on them, perhaps taking the objects from the laboratories and returning them back to the ship. But that scenario was impossible because all the labs were equipped with personalized lock systems, and none of the labs were broken into. The scientists were baffled, but after a few weeks a pattern emerged. Every item from the ship, regardless of where it was, whether it was in another part of the country, or some other place in the world, vanished exactly 3 days from when taken out of the ship. Items then emerged back on the ship precisely the moment they vanished, or thereabouts, since time was tricky business on the ship and difficult to gauge. As the scientists had suspected, the alien ship somehow remained in contact with its brood, no matter the distance or location from the mother ship. There was so much magic in that craft that it was practically impossible for the scientists to remain focused on their work. At times, the scientists showed signs associated with psychosis. Their personalities gyrated from giddy with delight to frustration and demonic despair. On several occasions, guards were called into the labs to restrain a belligerent scientist who was making preposterous accusations and demands on one of his assistants. One scientist commanded a coworker to kneel and kiss a ring on his finger, then cried hysterically when his colleague refused the demand. Another threatened to kill the colleague's family if he didn't receive a birthday card from him. Two others played like children, singing and clapping their hands while talking to make-believe friends. Those cases are a small sampling of strange happenings that took place and affected many of those involved with the covert projects. Those were not episodes of bored scientists horsing around with their colleagues. Many of those affected had to be restrained and taken off the base. Some of them recovered within a few days and or weeks, and had little recollection of what happened to them. But in a few cases the scientists had to be institutionalized permanently. The scientists were never able to master the alien instruments because the instruments seemed to play mind games with them, kind of a Simon Says routine: do as I say, not as I do. The instruments didn't talk, verbally anyway, which would not have been surprising since they seemed to be able to do everything else, including sending messages to other devices and to the technicians via extrasensory means. Headline: Psychics Attempt to Unlock the Mysteries. The committee tried using psychics to unlock some of the secrets of the aliens. The expectation was that clairvoyants would be less intimidated working in areas that were paranormal in nature, and too strange for down-to-earth types like scientists to handle. From the onset, some of the psychics could not cope with what they were shown and put in contact with, and handled some situations much worse than the scientists. Many of the clairvoyants simply freaked out, as one scientist put it. There were a few who overcame the initial shock and actually communicated with the alien objects. But shortly after doing so, more than half of them developed psychosis, and were dropped from the program. There are many layers of scientists who work on these highly classified projects. Some know the truth and the origin of what they are working on, others are kept in the dark and believe that they are working on highly advanced, human-based, scientific projects for the military and private industry. Of the 30-plus groups that participated in the program, none communicate with each other, or even knew of the other's existence. All the groups reported their findings and results to a single committee. Each unit had two or three specialists chosen from diverse fields, such as physics, medicine, engineering, psychiatry, astronomy, parapsychology, mathematics, and even the clergy. All the sciences and philosophies were represented. The committee to which these specialists reported was comprised of 7 individuals. That number changed through the years, as did the numbers of scientists in the program. Some of the committee members represented and came from the ranks of the military. The rest were civilians. All were personally recruited by the President of the United States. That policy changed in the 60s, and now no one knows how people get in. After reviewing many of the first reports given to them by the scientists, the committee as a whole was certain about only one thing, that whatever the aliens are, they allowed the human race to keep the alien craft with all its marvels, as a gift. But perhaps of the Trojan horse variety was the concern of some in the committee. Committee members were well aware that the aliens had the capacity to take back their ship at any time, yet, why didn't they? The committee knew the aliens could do this after they learned how independent each individual gadget on the ship was, as was the ship itself. The ship was capable of operating independently without the assistance of the alien crew, but some in the committee believed that the gadgets were the alien crew. It was apparent to the committee that after the craft fixed itself that there was nothing that could keep it from leaving on its own. What puzzled them was why they were allowed to have the ship in the first place. The mission of the committee was to find a weakness in the alien ship. But the more they probed, the more they realized how weak human technology was in comparison to the alien technology. One scientist in the memo exclaimed, "There was no comparison to human and alien technology. We are merely over, the aliens are Einstein to the nth degree." That is why every president, starting with Harry Truman, was unable to confirm the existence of UFOs, but was forced to deny their existence. No president was going to come out and tell the world that there are aliens from other worlds on our planet that can squash the human race as if it were nothing more than a gnat. Two of the psychics that were brought into the program did what their colleagues couldn't, and after initial failures, began to excel at breaking through a few of the complexities of how alien objects operated. The psychics communicated telepathically on a very basic level, like a first grader directing questions to a college professor. The alien objects, the professors, alien gadgets, were amused and sometimes made an effort to explain complex material to the first graders, psychics. However, big discoveries come from many little steps, and throughout the years several little steps fell into place like pieces of a puzzle. One of the small steps led the scientists towards a huge breakthrough. They figured out how to unlock the secrets to a certain batch of alien devices that most of the scientists had given up on. One of those gadgets made openings appear where none existed. That device made it possible to walk through walls or other barriers regardless of the composition or thickness. There are no man-made or natural materials that didn't yield to that instant alien doormaker. The operation of it was effortless. The scientists simply willed themselves through the barrier while in possession of that peculiar item. That device did not change shape, as did many of the other alien items. It was about the size of a piece of chalk, the kind that teachers use for writing on blackboards, except that it was black. The gadget had a strange absorption quality to it and gave the person that was holding it the sensation that he could be sucked into it like being sucked into a miniature black hole. When the chalk-like object activated, lights at the area dimmed and it seemed to also pull energy from its surroundings. Electrical items in the vicinity, such as appliances, televisions, radios, lights, and to some degree, humans and pets, since humans and animals are electrical, were also affected. The device pulled the heat out of the room or area that it was used in as if a cold front had moved through. Scientists using the device often wore suitable clothing for the sudden chill, which was awkward when temperatures outside were hot and sticky. The person holding it had the sensation of suction similar to holding a vacuum cleaner nozzle to bare skin. Another interesting device the psychics brought to life served to immobilize a person or animal and kept the victim paralyzed for an indefinite length of time. The device was similar to a laser pointer, except for the fact that the beam projected 3 feet then stopped, like a slim version of the Star Wars lightsaber. That alien lightsaber instantly paralyzed man or beast the moment the light came in contact with the cranium. Under the paralysis, the person or animal remained fully conscious, but were unable to move in any way except for blinking of the eyelids. People touched by this beam were literally frozen in their strides and had to be kept from falling, if they were off balance, and let down gently. Otherwise they sustained injuries from falling. They remained in that frozen state as long as the beam made contact with any part of the head. Once the beam was turned off or away from the person regained mobility in 1 or 2 minutes. Additionally, the person affected by the ray suffered a mild case of amnesia and disorientation. Also, they never recalled what happened to them moments before, during, and after the paralysis. One scientist who succumbed to the paralysis during an experiment equated it to a high pitch ringing in the ears, accompanied by a mild dizzy spell, which lasted less than a minute, once the beam was removed from his head. Every new breakthrough whetted the appetite of the committee, and when the discoveries waned they became impatiently hungry for more. It was in one of those lulls that the committee seriously began discussing the use of civilians as guinea pigs. The psychics weren't producing the consistent results the committee was hoping for. There was too much downtime between discoveries, which left large gaps in the workloads of scientists and technicians. That was unacceptable due to the vast alien cargo that begged to be unlocked, and its secret mysteries unleashed. Putting pressure on the psychics only quickened their burnout rate, which was high, and qualified replacements were difficult to find. Therefore, alternatives were explored. Had the psychics made better progress, it might have alleviated the committee from making the dreadful decisions they were faced with. Experimenting on unsuspecting people was put on the front burner. The decision to experiment on people posed a dilemma for some of the committee members. How would they carry out experimentation on human subjects and still be able to sleep at night? And that was the compassionate component of the problem. There were potential legal issues should that evil deed ever get out into the public. The legality of it all presented more of a challenge. Would they be tried as war criminals or monsters, if not both? Those kinds of questions surfaced more often as the decade of the 40s, where violations against humans were easier to hide and were also more acceptable by certain governments. However, as the cause for the greater good era turned into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where the mood of the nation changed radically against Big Brother-type government institutions as benefactors of the people to outright mistrust of higher authority, Americans became more cynical and suspicious of the military and the government in general as a consequence of the Vietnam War. Even the most hard-boiled among the committee members knew that it was only a matter of time before their covert organization would be discovered and exposed. When that day comes, heads will roll, like at the French Revolution with the guillotine, proclaimed one of the scientists in the report. None believe it would happen in their lifetime, but there was always that possibility. There were no easy answers, especially since the committee itself was venomously divided on that one issue. Because of the rift, it was feared that someone on the team might leak that information to the press. Concerns over using human specimens in the labs were prevalent in the 70s, but it was also an issue at the onset of the cover program. After reviewing several options concerning the use of people to experiment on in the late 40s, the first committee resolved their dilemma rather easily. They would take the alien gadgets and do experiments in the battlefield. The idea was proposed by two of the military personnel that were members of the committee. They made that suggestion to their colleagues on the committee after returning from a White House briefing with the President and his chiefs of staff. At the briefing, they learned that the possibility of America going to war with Korea was highly probable. They were told at the meeting that such a scenario would solve several problems. The committee could set up a MASH unit near the front lines and take in the worst casualties of the war. Many things can be hidden in battle zones when the obvious dangers are overlooked. Few in the committee were excited about going into the battlefield, or exposing the scientific people who worked for the committee to that kind of danger. Dead soldiers tell no tales. That was the bottom line. Secrecy was paramount, and fresh meat plentiful in the hellhole of war. The use of mortally wounded soldiers was no less repugnant back then as it is now, unless they were enemy soldiers. The committee subjected soldiers and other victims of the war to experiments for the betterment of mankind, and only those with a low probability of survival were taken. The war provided them with multiple opportunities. They had the use of captured prisoners and enemy casualties to experiment on. They also tested the alien devices for suitability as weapons. But before the operation got off the ground, they had many obstacles to work out. The alien gadgets regrouped back on the ship every 3 days, so they had to figure out a way to get the ship nearer to the war zone. Moving it created other problems. Various unrelated research programs existed that required the ship to remain where it was. The site was not disclosed. Human experimentation was a fraction of the whole program that was taking place around the alien craft during those years. Cutting off other interested entities was a strategic nightmare, and lots of toes got stepped on in the scramble to retain influence over the ship. How and to what extent the alien gadgets affected the human anatomy was of the greatest concern to the powers that be. Therefore, it was that research group that control of the ship was given over to. The alien ship went wherever that unit of scientists was sent. Okinawa, Japan was that place. It was just minutes away by air from Korea, and there was already a large American military presence on that island. At that time, Okinawa belonged to the American military after the defeat of Japan during World War II. The Japanese economy on the mainland, as well as some of the islands, was undergoing a massive revamping of the economy and infrastructure with the help of the United States government. The installation of a highly classified operation as that one was, took place without anyone noticing. There were American scientists in Japan that were studying the effects of radiation poisoning on the victims of the atomic war. Only 5 years earlier, in 1945, atom bombs were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The devastation of that war was still apparent in 1950, when the committee set up its headquarters in the region. The exact location the committee chose for the harbor of the alien ship was never disclosed, and was only located on the island for the duration of the Korean War. There were those in the committee who had compassion for the Japanese people after witnessing the effects of the bombs on that country. They hoped to learn enough about the alien instruments to undo some of the radiation damage that inflicted thousands of Japanese people. They did not perform experiments on the Japanese. They waited until there was conclusive evidence on what the instruments were capable of doing before any attempt was made to treat civilians with the alien technology. In a war situation, where life and death, misery and brutality, flashed by at a rapid pace daily, few committee members felt that what they were about to do in Korea was wrong. They knew that humanity was given a gift, the alien craft filled with untold possibilities, and it was their job to put those gadgets to good use. Others in the committee felt that what they had in their possession could also be subverted and made into a weapon that would unleash a nightmare onto the world, a nightmare that would eclipse the horror of the atom bombs that were dropped on Japan. As the committee had expected from information given to them by sources in their organization, the Soviet-trained forces of North Korea invaded South Korea in the summer of 1950. Within days of that invasion, United Nations troops led by General Douglas MacArthur entered the fighting and began pushing the North Korean troops back behind the 38th parallel. 2.5 years earlier, the committee had come into possession of the alien craft. Now, with the war started, they knew they were on the verge of unlocking some of the most fantastic secrets in the universe. It was not a smooth-going operation. Just as they set up camp, advancing North Korean troops overran them. More than once they ended up losing doctors and technicians, as well as the alien instruments. The difference was that the instruments always returned to the ship undamaged, where they were retrieved again and again. Not so for the scientists. The experiments were haphazard. The stress of being minutes from the front lines and always in fear of being overrun by enemy troops took its toll on the staff. Of the 3 years that the war lasted, only a few months of it was considered productive. The bulk of what had been studied was lost in transit from having to move so often, and the rest was lost when the camp came under fire and was destroyed. Much of what was salvaged was suspect because of the brutal conditions under which it was collected. The team members chose to work close to the front lines so that they could work with injured soldiers that were fresh off the battlefield and with some remaining life in them. The MASH unit did serve in its true capacity and doctored wounded soldiers without experimenting on them. The scientists and doctors only experimented with the soldiers who were found to be beyond hope. Nevertheless, progress was made during those years. The committee was able to forward a breakdown describing the usefulness of certain alien gadgets in treating disease like malaria, and dysentery instantly, and reversing the effects of frostbite and restoring eyesight by performing delicate surgery. According to a report, hundreds of miraculous recoveries from every conceivable ailment and war wound took place without the time and ability of the technicians to document how they actually achieved those results. Those that were helped by the alien gadgets included North and South Korean civilian refugees, and soldiers from both sides of the conflict. That particular committee was not privy to the nature or extent that the alien items were used as weapons, or even if they were. Any such tests were carried out by other covered units and monitored by other committees. The President of the United States was briefed daily on all findings regarding this project. He was given a summary that described in detail some of the more prominent findings and occurrences from the committee. The report gave a description of the gadgets and what some of their functions were, a sketch of what the gadgets looked like when they morphed into operation, activated, and performed their magic was sent along with the reports. The sketches were of little help and only served to show what the item looked like for a brief time during the period it took to sketch it. Change was the only constant concerning the alien gadgets. Once they activated, they oscillated continuously from one shape to another, and sometime their color would do the same. One scientist described them as having similar attributes as squids and chameleons, with their abilities to change color rapidly. All of the objects in the report were identified with at least one function, although the report stated that every gadget could possibly perform dozens, even hundreds of other roles. One report stressed that it would take years of study just to scratch the surface of what these things are capable of doing. For that reason, some on the committee made suggestions to the president that certain items, those deemed not to pose a national security breach, be released on a limited basis to their civilian counterparts. They were convinced it was time to let the scientific community have accesses to a few of the alien gadgets. Their thoughts were that something of this magnitude needed to be studied by a broad range of institutions, so that the benefits could be discovered and put to use in the near future, not some far and distant future, which it would be if they had to continue working under the civilian radar. Others in the committee disagreed and felt that this could be a Trojan horse, rationalizing that the aliens might be trying to lure a human race into thinking they're benevolent or worse, to intimidate mankind by letting humans know what they are up against. The president was briefed on both views and decided that it was bad policy to acknowledge a power that was infinitely superior to anything on this planet. The reason, he told the committee members, was that the sense of balance and security that Americans enjoyed could be disrupted by that kind of revelation, possibly damaging the American economy and throwing it, and then the rest of the world, into chaos. He emphasized to the committee that he wasn't being melodramatic. The aliens were far too strange and unknowable, and the public was not ready to be awakened to the phenomena. He then added, "The committee and all of its subordinate units would become more shrouded in its operations, not less." It was no coincidence that expenditures in military spending increased with each succeeding president. The discovery of the alien ship in 1947 had everything to do with it. The Cold War with the USSR, Soviet Union, was more of a red herring than a real fear of communism. Not that Russia weren't dangerous and unpredictable, they were. And did deserve keeping an eye on. A quote in the memo from the president. After the discovery of the alien ship in Roswell, many at the top echelon of government were more fearful of things not of this world than anything from this world. Unfortunately, the Soviets, who were already paranoid about the Western world, and looked upon the United States as the only country that could keep them from swallowing Europe whole, mistook the American military buildup as a direct threat to them. Therefore, the Cold War escalated to a point that the two superpowers became the real threat to this planet, more so than any threat from the aliens. Headline: Alien Medical Instruments. An alien object described in one of the reports discovered during the Korean War was a rectangular device with smooth rounded edges. It was 1 inch wide by 2 inches long and had the thickness of 1/4 of an inch. Some gadgets such as that one held its shape longer than most alien gadgets. The color was sapphire, and smooth to the point that it was slippery, which made it extremely difficult to hold onto. It was described as an incredibly beautiful object. It looked like a large precious stone, one that would rival anything found in any prestigious jewelry store, remarked one committee member. However, every gadget in the ship equally charmed those who saw them and worked with the alien things. The alien gadgets were all seductively beautiful, which belied their immense power to do both good and evil. When that particular item was placed on a living body, it detected tumors, both malignant and benign ones. Once the tumor was identified, the alien object projected an exact image of it on its screen-like surface. The projected image was three-dimensional and could be viewed on all sides as the image rotated slowly. The gadget only needed to touch the skin once, it then glided a few centimeters over the skin. If tumors were not present, and if the body was free of cancerous growth, the object remained stationary and a cryptic message appeared on its surface. The object did not need to scan over the entire body to locate a tumor. Knew the location of any malignancy instantly as soon as the object touched the skin. If the cancer had spread in the body, the object moved about the body identifying and presumably cataloging each area the cancer had spread to. The scientists believed that the alien scanner was mapping the location of each tumor and making notes of all pertinent information about the kind of abnormal growth it was and storing that information somewhere. But they never discovered how or where the information was being stored, whether it was accumulated within the object itself or if it transmitted the data back to the alien craft. Several gadgets took on the appearance of earthly objects, especially in the surgical category. Often a surgeon on one of the teams would get the surprise of their lives when an instrument that looked like a scalpel suddenly changed into something else during use. One object that was on the report from the Korean experiments looked more like a kitchen utensil, a cheese slicer, and not a surgical tool. It had a 4-inch long tubular handle attached to a spatula with a slit in the middle of it. The object appeared to be made of the same stuff as the body scanner, except that its color was ruby red. The flat part of the item was about 2 inches wide with the length of 2.5 inches. The thickness was less than a double-edged razor blade. It effortlessly removed skin from one part of the body and miraculously grafted it to another part of the body. No sutures were required to hold the skin in place. As soon as the skin was applied, the wound completely healed itself in less than 5 minutes. The instrument accelerated the healing process at the injury site as it fused the grafted skin to the wound. The condition of the person receiving the skin did not have an effect on the healing process of the grafted area, even when there were lesions or other wounds that would not heal due to some underlying illness such as cancer or diabetes. With that device, they were able to graft skin from one person onto another with the same rate of success. Skin color likewise did not matter. Skin from blacks, Caucasians and Asians were all intermingled with the same astonishing results. The receiving body never rejected the grafted skin. The skin from the donor assumed the color and matrix of that of the recipient at the same rate that it healed. Many of the mistakes and injuries that occurred early in the program were actually due to the expertise of the doctors and scientists, not the lack of it. Many times the doctors tried to assist or force the instruments to perform in ways they thought the gadgets should perform, often with fatal consequences. Also, the mood and the attitude of the scientists seemed to dictate what and to what extent the gadgets functioned. There are markings on some of the instruments, but probably the markings had no more significance than the markings on our own earthly tools and utensils, for example trademarks. We don't need written instructions on our knives and forks, screwdrivers and hammers, to understand their function. The culture we live in teaches us about those things.